bodies have been hijacked. Dopamine employed to overthrow the fascist dictatorship of your prefrontal cortex. Now your brain is free of repression. Your mind free of censorship. Your awareness exposed to the turbulent seas of the unconscious. Through this open doorway, divine light shines into your consciousness, showing you the way. This is what makes you a Wayseer. 90% of human civilization is populated with those whose brains are blocked to the way. Their brains are hardwired to enforce the social programming indoctrinated since birth. Unlike you, they cannot break out of this programming because they have not yet experienced the necessary revolution of mind. These programmed people take social institutions and rules very seriously. Society is full of games programmed to keep people's minds occupied so they will not revolt. Often cause sick fixations on peculiar protocols, power structures, taboos, and domination. All subtle forms of human bondage. This distinct form of madness is not only tolerated by the masses, but insisted upon. The programmed ones believe in rules so forcefully, they become willing to destroy anyone who violates them. Wayseers are the ones who call their bluff. Since Wayseer minds are free to reject social programming, Wayseers readily see these social institutions for what they are, imaginary games. Wayseers comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. Helping those who are lost in these games and refuse to help themselves is the calling of many Wayseers. Since Wayseers are the ones who keep contact with the original source of reality, they are able to disrupt societal conventions and even governments to realign humanity with the way. The Wayseers are an ancient lineage, a kind of priesthood, carriers of the flame, ones in the know. There must always be Wayseers to reform the dizzying, psychotic, spinning wheels of society. Giant, mindless hamster wheels obscuring the pure blue sky.
Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you live with portions on recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, the exit door leads in. A short story by Philip K. Dick. Stay tuned. Well, this will be the last sort of formal Hour of the Wolf until June, as May will be the traditional month of begging. I know there's begathons on WBAI all around the calendar year, and they seem endless. Last one, I was preempted more or less for 6 weeks. 1 week because of a holiday, and 1 week I was on with a special, and four just preempted. That will not be the case this time out. As far as I've written the powers that be about a couple of proposals that for fundraising. And as far as I can tell, they're all being accepted. So actually, while this will be the last formal proper Hour of the Wolf, I hope to do several shows within that time, where, of course, we'll also be asking for money. Two of them will be very special. One will be actually in tandem with Robert Knight. Since I've been in this slot, he and I have never actually done a show together. And although he's been most gracious in giving me access to his airtime occasionally, but we'll explain this at the time. But he and I had what I thought was just a fascinating conversation about. We were talking about the John Carter books, the Barsoom books, at the time that the John Carter movie was coming out, and the taint of racism that Edgar Rice Burroughs' stories had from 100 years ago, and how should that be dealt with today? And the conversation was just really, really way cool, fascinating, wonderful stuff. And in the middle of it, this going back and forth, I said to him, you know, we really ought to do this as a show. So at some point during the fundraising drive, that's what we're going to do. We'll do that as a show. We don't know when yet. The fourth week of the thon, and I'm not sure of the date or the time, my guest will be Edward Einhorn. That's Einhorn. In preparation for his off-Broadway production of The Lathe of Heaven, based on the novel by Ursula K. Le Guin. And that is just thrilling, exciting, and all that. And we're going to have tickets for people who donate. That's just, you know, great, great stuff. So check in, and I'll let you know where I will be during the fundraising drive. OurWolf.com is one way, or follow me on Facebook. There is an Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. But also, well, okay, I'm going to tie this in. These are concentric circles of thought here. So Edward Einhorn's last SF-related off-off Broadway production was a brilliant rendition, the best adaptation I have seen so far of the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. Somebody also did an adaptation of it and renamed it Blade Runner. It was a movie with Harrison Ford or something like that. But I thought that movie had merit. It also had a lot of problems, but Edward Einhorn's adaptation just totally captured. That was the second theatrical presentation of Philip K. Dick that I thought was so good. The Mabu Mines did Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said. That was also very, very good. That goes back quite a few years, I'm afraid. It would be nice if they revived that. But how does that tie in? Okay, it ties in a couple of ways. That will be, you know, during the thon, I will be doing a show with Edward about Le Guin. Number two, this morning, I'm going to read you a short story by Philip K. Dick, so there's a tie-in there. And then, talking about thons, Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, is May Day. And that has two points of significance. Number one is, God help me, my 45th anniversary of working here at WBAI. I answered the call, almost literally, or rather I made the call to start here when I was 13 years old, during a fundraising drive. It was either the first or the second. I thought it was the very first marathon, but there are those who recall differently and say, no, that was the second fundraising drive. I have to ask Robbie Barish. He would remember. He would know. But anyway, 45 years. Yeeks. Next Tuesday. Understand I wasn't like on the air or anything. I was answering phones and, you know, just doing the work. And I hope that you folks, by the way, will answer that call to answer our calls as well. But in addition, I wasn't on the air for like, I guess a year and a half or 2 years, and I wasn't working here steadily at age 13. By age 15, I was. And by age 15, I was producing radio shows. So, you know, these things take time. But nevertheless, I regard May 1st, 1967 as my starting date. Now, on that same day, coincidentally, is the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading. And this is a reading series that I produce. And we have two amazing, wonderful writers, one of whom I know Robert is very familiar with. I believe Robert interviewed him once, and I know he reads him. And his name is John Shirley. And John Shirley is an amazing writer. I will read you the biography that he sent me, and I will inform you that this is censored, okay? And you'll be able to figure out easily how it's censored. Just, you know, assume that the guy didn't use the word freaking, okay? And his bio, as sent to me, is John Shirley, some freaking guy who walked in off the street every day for a week, smelling of beer and vomit and old cigarettes, and saying that if I didn't let him read, he was going to pee in the doorway of the venue every night. Finally, he convinced us. He is known as the writer of the Bram Stoker Award. He is also known as the winner, of the Bram Stoker Award for his story collection Black Butterflies, which was also chosen as one of the best books of the year by Publishers Weekly, and is the author of the Cyberpunk trilogy, A Song Called Youth, recently reissued in an omnibus by Prime Books. He is one of the original cyberpunk novelists with William Gibson, Bruce Sterling, Rudy Rucker, Pat Cadigan, and Lewis Shiner. He has a quote here from Bill Gibson. John Shirley was cyberpunk's patient zero, first locus of the virus, certifiably virulent, a carrier. John Shirley co-wrote the movie The Crow and also wrote 18 songs recorded by Blue Oyster Cult. His novel Demons remains in print. His newest novels are Bleak History, Bioshock Rapture, and Everything is Broken. He's writing a graphic novel, The Crow, Death is My Dojo. His newest short story collection is In Extremis, the most extreme stories of John Shirley. And Black October Records is issuing a compilation of John Shirley's own recordings with various bands. Broken Mirror Glass, John Shirley, 1978 to 2011. The other reader who we have next Tuesday is Michael Sisko, who's been on this show several times. John was on this show once, quite a few years ago, like 10 years ago. Michael Sisko is an omnibus on information on dark fantasy and horror literature. And when I say horror, I don't mean necessarily Stephen King. We're talking more H.P. Lovecraft, Shirley Jackson, Edgar Allan Poe, literary horror, I'm not, when I say great horror, I don't mean that, you know, the modern ilk aren't, but I do believe that they tend to be more visceral. But let me read you Michael's bio. Michael Sisko is the author of novels The Divinity Student, The Tyrant, The San Vinicio Canon, The Traitor, The Narrator, and The Great Lover, which, by the way, just last week was nominated for the Shirley Jackson Award. He also has a short story collection, Secret Hours. His fiction has appeared in Leviathan 3 and Leviathan 4, The Thackeray T. Lamb's Head Pocketbook to Eccentric and Discredited Diseases, a wonderful anthology, Lovecraft Unbound, Black Wings 1, Blood and Other Cravings, The Thackeray T. Lamb's Head, that dude again, Cabinet of Curiosities, and elsewhere. His alleged scholarly work has appeared in Lovecraft Studies, The Weird Fiction Review, and Iranian Studies. His upcoming publications include a new novel entitled Celebrant and an omnibus edition from Centipede Press. So, Michael's a teacher, by the way. He teaches here in New York City, I think at NYU. I'm not quite sure. So, those are our readers. Come, join us. Admission is free. This is next Tuesday, May Day, May 1st, at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. I suggest you get there then. With any luck, we'll be filling up, and I think we will. We do ask for donations at the door so that we can buy dinner for our readers. And the venue. Ah, yes, I should tell you all about the venue. It is at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is located at 138 Sullivan Street. That's between Houston and Prince. And if you stick with us after the reading, we all go out for drinks and dinner, and you are welcome to join us. So again, that's next Tuesday. Show up at 6:30 at 138 Sullivan Street. Admission is free. Donations are accepted for Michael Sisko and John Shirley at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Okay. We're going to have a special event reading as well. We usually do one a month, but Liz Gorinsky is going to be our guest curator for a special reading on May 22nd. And our readers there will be Charlie Jane Anders and Brian Francis Slattery. Both way cool. But you know what? I don't have time now. I've already wasted 15 minutes. I've got a whole reading to do. So I won't go into all the details, but you know what? You can join the Facebook group, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or send me an email. I will put you on my mailing list. And the place where you send me the email, it's simple. It's Jim. That's me, Jim, at OurWolf.com. OurWolf is spelled HOURWOLF.com. If you are a regular listener, well, the show is Hour of the Wolf on these airwaves for some 40 years now. So, this week a short story. We had a short story last week, but it was recorded. This week I am going to read one aloud. It is an extremely appropriate story, I think, for WBAI. It's very good anywhere, but this is a real thinking person's fun short story about, well, conformity versus nonconformity. When is it right to do what is labeled wrong, and so forth. Because I'm going to be reading aloud, normally I'm very laissez-faire. I've got the door open and, you know, be it what it may, but during the reading, I'll close the door. So pardon me as I get off totally off mic, totally unprofessional, but hey, that's another hallmark of WBAI, right? Okay, back on. And let me see, when this story was written is very relevant. I think that his novels are his best work. 1979, so I was right, yeah, this is a late story. As brilliant as his novels were, and they're not just launching points for movies, although God knows we have one or two Philip K. Dick movies coming out a year. Occasionally, they have a little something to do with what Dick has written. More often than not, they're just, as I say, launching points. And his short stories are among his great works. I think his novels, like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, The Man in the High Castle, I think most people would acknowledge as his best novel. I'm a big fan of a book called Ubik, U-B-I-K, which Dick actually wrote a screenplay for, but don't know that anything is likely ever to happen with it, sadly, even though he wrote his own screenplay. It's... Well, the one thing that he would have probably approved of, it's very difficult to believe, by the way, that he's been dead now for 31 years. I met him once. I did about a 5-minute, really terrible interview with him. Mike Odell, a counterpart of mine who was mostly through the years at KPFK, did some wonderful interviews with Philip K. Dick. And on the DVD of the movie A Scanner Darkly, which may be one of the better, well, certainly one of the better Philip K. Dick movies, but also one that really is recognizable as Dick's writing. As a DVD extra, they put together Mike Hodell's interviews with Philip K. Dick from Pacifica Radio. Thank you very much. And... they're all on there if you are interested. This story is one of Dick's later stories. And as he was getting into his later years, and, you know, he died young. I think he was about 53 years old when he died. And he was just becoming that much more literate. He had gone through his drug phases, his mental curiosity issues and things like that, and he was coming out the other side with works like Scanner Darkly and various short stories, and this one, which I've read on the air before, but not in this time slot. This one is one of his best late short stories. It is entitled, The Exit Door Leads In. Bob Beitelman had the impression that robots wouldn't look you in the eye, and when one had been in the vicinity, small, valuable objects disappeared. A robot's idea of order was to stack everything into one pile. Nevertheless, Beitelman had to order lunch from robots since vending ranked too low in the wage scale to attract humans. A hamburger, fries, strawberry shake, and Beitelman paused reading the printout. Make that a supreme double cheeseburger, fries, a chocolate malt. Wait a minute, the robot said. I'm already working on the burger. You want to buy into this week's contest while you're waiting? I don't get the royal cheeseburger, Beitelman said. That's right. It was hell living in the 21st century. Information transfer had reached the velocity of light. Beitelman's older brother had once fed a 10-word plot outline into a robot fiction machine, changed his mind as to the outcome, and found out that the novel was already in print. He had had to program a sequel in order to make the correction. "Well, what's the prize structure in this contest?" Beitelman asked. At once the printout posted all the odds from first prize down to last. Naturally, the robot blanked out the display before Beitelman could read it. "Well, what's the first prize?" Beitelman said. "I can't tell you that," the robot said. From its slot came a hamburger, french fries, and a strawberry shake. "That'll be $1,000, cash." "Give me a hint," Beitelman said as he paid. "It's everywhere and nowhere. It's existed since the 17th century. Originally, it was invisible. Then it became royal. You can't get it unless you're smart, although cheating helps, and so does being rich. What does the word heavy suggest to you?"
Profound.
No, the literal meaning. The mass, Beitelman pondered. Well, what is this, a contest to see who can figure out what the prize is? I give up. "Pay the $6, the robot said, "to cover our costs, and you will receive an..." "Gravity!" Beitelman broke in. "Sir Isaac Newton, the Royal College of England, am I right?"
"Right,"
the robot said. $6 entitles you to a chance to go to college, a statistical chance at the posted odds."
"What is $6?
"Pratt fare." Beitelman handed over a $6 coin. "You win," the robot said. "You get to go to college. You beat the odds, which were 2,000,000,000,000 to 1 against you. Let me be the first to congratulate you. If I had a hand, I would shake hands with you. This will change your life. This has been your lucky day."
"It's a setup," Beitelman said, feeling a rush of anxiety.
"You are right," the robot said, and it looked Beitelman right in the eye. "It is also mandatory that you accept your prize. The college is a military college located in..." "Egypt, so to speak. Nowhere Egypt. But that's no problem. You'll be taken there. Go home and start packing."
"Well, let me eat my hamburger and drink. I suggest you start packing right away."
Behind Beitelman, a man and woman had lined up. Reflexively, got out of their way, trying to hold on to his tray of food, feeling dizzy.
"A charboiled steak sandwich," the man said. "Onion rings, root beer, and that's it,"
the robot said. "Care to buy into the contest? Terrific prizes." It flashed the odds on its display panel.
When Bob Beitelman unlocked the door of his one-room apartment, the telephone was on. It was looking for him.
"There you are," the telephone said. "I'm not going to do it," Beitelman said.
"Sure you are," the phone said. "Do you know who this is? Read over your certificate, your first prize legal form. You hold the rank of Shavetail. I am Major Casals. You are under my jurisdiction. If I tell you to pee purple, you will pee purple. How soon can you be on a transplant rocket? Do you have friends you want to say goodbye to? Maybe a sweetheart, your mother?"
Am I coming back?" Beitelman said with anger. I mean, who are we fighting, this college? I mean, for what matter? What college is it? Who's on the faculty? Is this a liberal arts college, or does it specialize in hard sciences? Is it government-sponsored? Does it offer..."
"Just calm down," Major Casals said quietly. Beitelman seated himself. He discovered that his hands were shaking. To himself, he thought, I was born in the wrong century. 100 years ago, this wouldn't have happened, and 100 years from now, it'll be illegal. What I need is a lawyer. His life had been a quiet one. He had, over the years, advanced in the modest position of floating home salesman. For a man 22 years old, that wasn't bad. He almost owned his one-room apartment, which is to say, he rented with an option to buy. It was a small life, as lives went. He did not ask too much, and he did not complain, normally, at what he received. Although he did not understand the tax structure that cut through his income, he accepted it. He accepted a modified state of penury the same way he accepted it when a girl would not go to bed with him. In a sense, this defined him. This was his measure. He submitted to what he did not like, and he regarded this attitude as a virtue. Most people in authority over him considered him a good person. As to those over whom he had authority, well, that was a class with zero members. His boss at Cloud Nine Homes told him what to do, and his customers really told him what to do. The government told everyone what to do, or so he assumed. He had very few dealings with the government. That was neither virtue or a vice. It was merely good luck. Once he had experienced vague dreams. They had to do with going to the poor. In high school, he had read Charles Dickens and had a vivid idea of the oppressed had fixed itself in his mind to the point where he could see them, all those who did not have a one-room apartment and a job in a high school education. Certain vague place names had floated through his head, gleaned from TV. Places like India, where heavy-duty machinery swept up the dying. Once a teaching machine had told him, you have a good heart. That amazed him. Not that a machine would say so, but that it would say so to him. A girl had told him the same thing. He marveled at this. Vast forces colluding to tell him that he was not a bad person. It was a mystery and a delight. But those days had passed. He no longer read novels, and the girl had been transferred to Frankfurt. Now he had been set up by a robot, a cheap machine, to shovel crap in the boonies, dragooned by a mechanical scan that was probably pulling citizens off the street in record numbers. This was not a college he was going to. He had won nothing. He had won a stint at some kind of forced labor camp, most likely. The exit door leads in, he thought to himself, which is to say, when they want you, they already have you. All they need is the paperwork. And a computer can process the forms at the touch of a key. The H key for hell and the S key for slave, he thought, and the Y key for you. Don't forget your toothbrush, he thought. You may need it. On the phone screen, Major Casals regarded him, as if silently estimating the chances that Bob Bibleman might bolt. 2 trillion to 1 I will, Bibleman thought. But the one will win, as in the contest. I will do what I am told. Please, Bibleman said, let me ask you one thing and give me an honest answer. Of course, Major Casals said. If I hadn't gone up to that Earl Senior robot and we'd have gotten you anyhow, Major Casals said. Okay, Bibleman said, nodding. Thanks. It makes me feel better. I don't have to tell myself stupid stuff like, if only I hadn't felt like a hamburger and fries, if only... He broke off. I'd better pack. Major Casals says, we've been running an evaluation on you for several months. You're overly endowed for the kind of work you do and undereducated. You need more education. You're entitled to more education. Astonished, Bibleman said, you're talking about this as if it's a genuine college. It is. It's the finest in the system. It isn't advertised. Something like this can't be. No one selects it. The college selects you. Those were not joke odds that you saw posted. You can't really imagine being admitted to the finest college in the system by this method, can you, Mr. Bibleman? You have a lot to learn. How long will I be at the college? Bibleman said. Major Casals said, until you have learned. They gave him a physical, a haircut, a uniform, and a place to bunk down, and many psychological tests. Bibleman suspected that if the true purpose of the test was to determine if you were latent homosexual, and that he suspected that his suspicions indicated that he was latent homosexual, so he abandoned the suspicions and supposed instead that they were sly intelligence and aptitude tests, and he informed himself that he was showing both intelligence and aptitude. He also informed himself that he looked great in his uniform, even though it was the same uniform that everyone else wore. That's why they call it a uniform, he reminded himself as he sat on the edge of his bunk reading his orientation pamphlets. The first pamphlet pointed out that it was a great honor to be admitted to the college. That was its name, the one word. How strange, he thought, puzzled. It's like naming your cat cat and your dog dog. This is my mother, Mrs. Mother, and this is my father, Mr. Father. Are these people working right? He wondered. It had been a phobia of his for years that someday he would fall into the hands of madmen. In particular, madmen who seemed sane up until the last moment. To Bibleman, this was the essence of horror. As he sat scrutinizing the pamphlets, a red-haired girl wearing the college uniform came over and seated herself beside him. She seemed perplexed. Maybe you can help me, she said. What is a syllabus? It says here that we're going to be given a syllabus. This place is screwing up my head. Bibleman said, we've been dragooned off the streets to shovel crap. You think so? I know so. Well, can't we just leave? You leave first, Bibleman said. I'll wait and see what happens to you. The girl laughed. I guess you don't know what a syllabus is. Yeah, sure I do. It's an abstract of courses or topics. Oh, yeah? And pigs can whistle. He regarded her. The girl regarded him. We're going to be here forever, the girl said. Her name, she told him, was Mary Lorne. She was, he decided, pretty, wistful, afraid, and putting up a good front. Together they joined the other new students for a showing of recent Herbie the Hyena cartoon in which Bibleman had seen. It was the episode in which Herbie attempted to assassinate the Russian monk Rasputin. In his usual fashion, Herbie the Hyena poisoned his victim, shot him, blew him up 6 times, stabbed him, tied him up with chains, and sank him in the Volga, tore him apart with wild horses, and finally shot him to the moon strapped to a rocket. The cartoon bored Bibleman. He didn't give a damn about Herbie the Hyena or Russian history, and he wondered if this was a sample of the college's level of pedagogy. He could imagine Herbie the Hyena illustrating Heisenberg's indeterminacy principle. Herbie, in Bibleman's mind, chafed after by a subatomic particle fruitlessly, the particle bobbing up at random here and there, Herbie making wild swings at it with a hammer, and the whole flock of subatomic particles jeering at Herbie, who was doomed, as always, to screw up. What are you thinking about? Mary whispered to him. The cartoon ended. The lights came on. There stood Major Casals on the stage, larger than on the phone. The fun is over, Bibleman said to himself. He could not imagine Major Casals chasing subatomic particles fruitlessly with wild swings of a sledgehammer. He felt himself grow cold and grim and a little afraid. The lecture had to do with classified information. Behind Major Casals, a giant hologram lit up with a schematic diagram of a homeostatic drilling rig. Within the hologram, the rig rotated so that they could see it from all angles. Different stages of the rig's interior glowed in various colors. I asked what you were thinking, Mary whispered. We have to listen, Bibleman said quietly. Mary said equally quietly. It finds titanium ore on its own. Big deal. Titanium is the 9th most abundant element in the crust of the planet. I'd be impressed if it could seek out and mine pure wurtzite, which is only found in Potosi, Bolivia, Butte, Montana, and Goldfield, Nevada. Well, why is that? Bibleman said. Because, Mary said, wurtzite is unstable at temperatures below 1,000 degrees centigrade. And further, she broke off. Major Casals had ceased talking and was looking at her. Would you repeat that for all of us, young woman? Major Casal said. Standing, Mary said, Quartzite is unstable at temperatures below 1,000 degrees centigrade. Her voice was steady. Immediately, the hologram behind Major Casal switched to a readout of data on zinc sulfide minerals.
I don't see Quartzite listed, Major Casal said.
It's given on the chart in its inverted form, Mary said, her arms folded, which is sphalerite. Correctly, it is ZNS of the sulfide group of the AX type. It's related to green octite.
Sit down, Major Casal said.
The readout within the hologram now showed the characteristics of green octite. As she seated herself, Mary said, I'm right. They don't have a homeostatic drilling rig for Quartzite because there is no...
Your name is, Major Casal said, pen and pad poised.
Mary Wirtz. Her voice was totally without emotion. My father was Charles Adolf Wirtz.
The discoverer of Quartzite, Major Casal said uncertainly. His pen wavered.
That's right, Mary said. Turning towards Bibleman, she winked.
Thank you for the information, Major Casal said.
He made a motion and the hologram now showed a flying buttress, and in comparison to it, a normal buttress.
My point, Major Casal said, is simply that certain information, such as architectural principles of long-standing...
Most architectural principles are long-standing, Mary said.
Major Casal paused.
Otherwise, they would serve no purpose, Mary said.
Why not? Major Casal said, and then he colored.
Several uniformed students laughed.
Information of that type, Major Casal continued, is not classified, but a good deal of what you are going to be learning is classified. That is why the college is under military charter. To reveal or transmit or make public classified information given you during your schooling here falls under the jurisdiction of the military. For a breach of these statutes, you will be tried by a military tribunal.
The students murmured. To himself, Bibleman thought, bang, ganged, and then some. No one spoke. Even the girl beside him was silent. A complicated expression had crossed her face, however, a deeply introverted look. Somber, and he thought, totally, unusually mature. It made her seem older, no longer a girl. It made him wonder just how old she really was. It was as if in her features a thousand years had surfaced before him as he scrutinized her and pondered the officer on the stage and the great information hologram behind him. What is she thinking? He wondered. Is she going to say something more? How could she not be afraid to speak up? We're told that we're under military law.
Major Casal said, I'm going to give you an instance of a strictly classified cluster of data. It deals with a Panther engine. Behind him, the hologram, surprisingly, became blank.
Sir, one of the students said, the hologram isn't showing anywhere.
This is not an area with which you will deal during your studies here, Major Casal said. The Panther engine is a two-rotor system, opposed rotors serving a common main shaft. Its main advantage is the total lack of centrifugal torque in the housing. A cam chain is thrown between the opposed rotors, which permits the main shaft to reverse itself without hysteresis.
Behind him, the big hologram remained blank.
Strange, Bibleman thought, an eerie sensation. Information without information, as if the computer had gone blind.
Major Casal said, the college is forbidden to release any information about the Panther engine. It cannot be programmed to do otherwise. In fact, it knows nothing about the Panther engine. It is programmed to destroy any information it receives in that sector.
Raising his hand, a student said, so even if someone fed information into the college about the Panther,
it would eject the data, Major Casal said.
Is this a unique situation? Another student asked.
No,
Major Casal said.
Then there's a number of areas we can't get printouts for? A student murmured.
Nothing of importance, Major Casal said, at least so far as your studies are concerned.
The students were silent. The subjects which you will study, Major Casale said, will be assigned to you based on your aptitude and personality profiles. I will call off your names, and you will come forward for your allocation of topic assignment. The college itself has made the final decision for each of you, so you can be sure no error has been made. What if I get proctology? Bibleman asked himself. In panic, he thought, or podiatry, or herpetology. Or suppose the college, in its infinite computeroid wisdom, decides to ram into me all the information in the universe pertaining to or resembling herpes, or things even worse. If there is anything worse. What do you want, Mary said as the names were read alphabetically, is a program that's going to earn you a living. You have to be practical. I know what I'm going to get. I know where my strong point lies. It'll be chemistry. His name was called. Rising, he walked up the aisle to Major Casale's. They looked at each other, and then Casale's handed him an unsealed envelope. Stiffly, Bibleman returned to his seat. Do you want me to open it? Mary said. Wordlessly, Bibleman passed the envelope to her. She opened it and studied the printout. Can I earn a living with it? He said. She smiled. Yes, it's a high-paying field, almost as good as, well, let's just say that the colony planets are really in need of this. You could go to work anywhere. Looking over her shoulder, he saw the words on the page. Cosmology, cosmogony, pre-Socratics. Pre-Socratic philosophy, Mary said. Almost as good as structural engineering. She passed him the paper. Now, I shouldn't kid you. No, it's not really something you can make a living at unless you teach. But maybe it interests you. Does it interest you? No, he said, shortly. I wonder why the college picked it then, Mary said. What the hell, he said, is cosmogony? It's how the universe came into being. Aren't you interested in how the universe... She paused, eyeing him. You certainly won't be asking for printouts of any classified material. Maybe that's it. They won't have to watchdog you, she murmured to herself. I can be trusted with classified material, he said. Can you? Do you know yourself? But you'll be getting into that when the college bombards you with early Greek thought. Know thyself, Apollo's motto at Delphi. It sums up half of Greek philosophy. Bibleman said, I'm not going up before a military tribunal for making public classified military material. He thought then about the Panther engine, and he realized, fully realized, that a really grim message had been spelled out in that little lecture by Major Casale's. I wonder what Herbie the Hyena's motto is, he said. Mary said, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid. She reached out to touch him on the arm. Remember that? The Herbie a Hyena cartoon version of Richard III? Mary Lorne, Major Casale said, reading off the list. Oh, excuse me. She went up, returned with her envelope, smiling. Leprology, she said to Bibleman, the study and treatment of leprosy. I'm kidding you, it's chemistry. You'll be studying classified material, Bibleman said. Yes, she said. I know. On the first day of his study program, Bob Bibleman set his college input-output terminal on audio and punched the proper key for his coded course. Thales of Miletus, the terminal said, the founder of the Ionian School of Natural Philosophy. What did he teach? Bibleman asked. That the world floated on water, was sustained by water, and originated in water. Well, that's really stupid, Bibleman said. The college terminal said, Thales bases on the discovery of fossil fish far inland, even at high altitudes, so it is not as stupid as it sounds. It showed on its holoscreen a great deal of written information, no part of which struck Bibleman as very interesting. Anyhow, he had requested audio.
It is generally considered that Thallus was the first rational man in history, the terminal said.
What about Ignatin? Bibleman said.
He was strange. Moses, likewise strange. Hammurabi?
How do you spell that?
Well, I'm not sure. I've just heard the name. Then we will discuss Anaximander, the college terminal said, and in a cursory initial survey, Anaximenes, Xenophanes, Pyramides, Melissus, wait a second, I forgot, Heraclitus, and Cratilius. And we will study Empedocles, Anaxares, Zeno, Christ, Bibleman said. That's a different program, the college terminal said.
Just continue, Bibleman said.
Are you taking notes?
Well, that's none of your business.
You seem to be in a state of conflict.
Well, what happens to me if I flunk out of college?
You go to jail. Okay, I'll take notes. Since you are so driven...
What?
Well, since you are so full of conflict, you should find some of the philosophers interesting. The first dialectical philosopher, Empedocles believed that the basis of reality was an antithetical conflict between the forces of love and strife. Under love, the whole cosmos is a duly proportionate mixture called a krasis. The krasis is a spherical deity, a single perfect mind which spends all its time...
Is there any practical application to any of this? Bibleman interrupted.
The two antithetical forces of love and strife resemble the Taoist elements of yin and yang with their perpetual interaction from which all change takes place.
Practical application?
Twin mutually opposed constituents on the holoscreen, a schematic diagram, very complex formed. The two-rotor panther engine.
What?
Bibleman said, sitting up in his seat. He made out the large words, Panther Hydrodrive System Top Secret, above the schematic, comprising the readout. Instantly, he pressed the print key. The machinery of the terminal whirred, and three sheets of paper slid down into the retrieve slot.
They overlooked it, Bibleman realized. This entry here in the college's memory banks relating to the Panther engine.
Somehow, the cross-referencing got lost. No one thought of pre-Socratic philosophy. I mean, who would expect an entry on an engine, a modern-day top-secret engine, under the category philosophy pre-Socratic?
I've got it in my hands, he said to himself as he swiftly lifted out the three sheets of paper.
He folded them up and stuck them into the notebook the college had provided.
I've hit it, he thought, right off the bat. What the hell am I going to do with these schematics? I can't hide them in my locker.
Then he thought, have I committed a crime already for asking for a written printout?
Empedocles, the terminal was saying, believed in four elements as being perpetually rearranged: earth, water, air, and fire. These elements eternally...
Click. Bibleman shut the terminal down. The holoscreen faded to opaque gray.
Too much learning doth make a man slow, he thought as he got to his feet and started from the cubicle.
Fast of wit, but slow of foot. Where the hell am I going to hide the schematics? He asked himself again as he walked rapidly down the hall towards the ascent tube.
Well, he realized, they don't know I have them. I can take my time.
The thing to do is hide them in a random place, as he decided as the tube carried him to the surface, and even if they find them, they won't be able to trace them back to me, not unless they go to the trouble of dusting for fingerprints.
This could be worth billions of dollars, he said to himself.
A great joy filled him. Then came the fear. He discovered that he was trembling. Will they ever be pissed, he said to himself, when they find out... I won't be peeing purple. They'll be peeing purple. The college itself will when it discovers its error. And the error, he thought, is on its part, not mine. The college screwed up, and that's too bad. In the dorm where his bunk was located, he found a laundry room maintained by a silent robot staff, and when no robot was watching, he hid the three pages of the schematics near the bottom of a large pile of bedsheets. As high as the ceiling, this pile, they won't get down to the schematics this year,
I've got plenty of time to decide what to do. Looking at his watch, he saw that the afternoon had almost come to an end. At 5 o'clock, he would be seated in the cafeteria, eating dinner with Mary. She met him a little after 5. Her face showed signs of fatigue. "How'd it go?" she asked as they stood in line with their trays.
Fine, Bibleman said.
"Did you get Zeno? I always like Zeno. He proved that motion is impossible. So I guess I'm still in my mother's womb."
"You look strange," she eyed him.
"I'm just sick of listening to how the earth rests in the back of a giant turtle."
"Or suspended on a long string," Mary said.
Together they made their way among the other students to an empty table.
"You're not eating much."
"Feeling like eating," Bibleman said as he drank his cup of coffee, "is what got me here in the first place."
"Well, you could flunk out and go to jail," Mary said.
"The college is programmed to say that. Much of it is just threats. Talk loudly and carry a small stick, so to speak."
"I have it," Bibleman said.
"You have what?" She ceased eating and regarded him.
"The Panther engine."
Gazing at him, the girl was silent.
"The schematics. Lower your voice. They missed a citation in the memory storage. Now I have them and I don't know what to do. Just start walking, probably, and hope no one stops me."
"They don't know? The college didn't self-monitor?"
"I've no reason to think that it's aware of what it did." "Jesus Christ," Mary said softly. "On your first day, you'd better do a lot of slow, careful thinking."
"I can destroy them," he said.
"Or sell them?"
He said, "I looked them over. There's an analysis on the final page. The Panther..."
"Just say it," Mary said. "It can be used as a hydroelectric turbine and costs in half. I can't understand the technical language, but I figured that much out. Cheap power source, very cheap."
"So everyone would benefit?"
He nodded. "Wow. They really screwed up," Mary said.
"What was it Casals told us? Even if someone fed data into the college about it, the college would eject the data."
She began eating slowly, meditatively.
"And they're withholding us from the public? It must be industry pressure. Nice."
"What should I do?"
Bibleman said.
"I can't tell you that. What I was thinking is, I could take the schematics to one of the colony planets where the authorities have less control. I could find an independent firm and make a deal with them. The government wouldn't know how..."
"They'd figure out where the schematics came from," Mary said.
"They trace it back to you."
"Well, then I'd better burn them."
Mary said,
"You have a difficult decision to make. On the one hand, you've classified information in your possession which you obtained illegally. On the other..."
"I didn't obtain it illegally," Bibleman said. "The college screwed up."
Calmly, she continued, "You broke the law, military law, when you asked for a written transcript. You should have reported the breach of security as soon as you discovered it. They would have rewarded you. Major Casals would have said nice things to you."
"I'm scared," Bibleman said. And he felt the fear moving around inside of him, shifting about and growing. As he held his plastic coffee cup, it shook, and some of the coffee spilled onto his uniform. Mary, with a paper napkin, dabbed at the coffee stain.
It won't come off," she said.
"Symbolism," Bibleman said.
"Lady Macbeth, I always wanted to have a dog named Spot, so I could say, 'Out, out, damned Spot.'"
I am not going to tell you what to do," Mary said. "This is a decision that you need to make alone. It isn't ethical for you to even discuss it with me. That could be considered conspiracy and put us both in prison."
"Prison?" he echoed.
"You have it within your..." "Christ, I was going to say, you have it within your power to provide a cheap power source to human civilization."
She laughed and shook her head.
"I guess this scares me, too. Do what you think is right. If you think it's right to publish the schematics..."
"I never thought of that.
Just
publish them, some newspaper or magazine. A slave printing construct could print it and distribute it all over the solar system in 15 minutes. All I have to do, he realized, is pay the fee and then feed in the 3 pages of schematics. It's as simple as that, and then spend the rest of my life in jail or anyhow in court. Maybe the adjudication would go in my favor. There are precedents in history where vital classified material, military classified material, was stolen and published. And not only was the person found innocent, but we now realize he was a hero. He served the welfare of the human race itself and risked his life. Approaching their table, two armed military security guards closed in on Bob Beidelman. He stared at them, not believing what he saw, but thinking, believe it. "Student Beidelman," one of them said. "It's on my uniform," Beidelman said. "Hold out your hand, student Beidelman." The larger of the two security guards snapped handcuffs on him. Mary said nothing. She continued slowly eating. In Major Casal's office, Beidelman waited, grasping the fact that he was being, as the technical term had it, detained. He felt glum. He wondered what they would do. He wondered if he had been set up. He wondered what he would do if he were charged. He wondered why it was taking so long. And then he wondered what it was all really about, and he wondered whether he would understand the grand issues if he continued with his courses in cosmology, cosmogony, pre-Socratics. Entering the office, Major Casal said briskly, "Sorry to keep you waiting." Can these handcuffs be removed?" Beidelman said. They hurt his wrists. They had been clapped on him as tightly as possible. His bone structure ached. "We couldn't find the schematics," Casal said, seating himself behind his desk. What schematics? "For the Panther engine." "There aren't supposed to be any schematics for the Panther engine. You told us that in orientation. Did you program your terminal for that deliberately, or did it just happen to come up?" "My terminal programmed itself to talk about water," Beidelman said. "The universe is composed of water." It automatically notified security when you asked for a written transcript. All written transcripts are monitored." "Screw you," Beidelman said. Major Casal said, "I tell you what. We're only interested in getting the schematics back. We're not interested in putting you in jail. Return them, and you won't be tried." "Return what?" Beidelman said, but he knew it was a waste of time. "Can I think it over?" "Yes." "Can I go? I feel like going to sleep. I'm tired. I feel like having these cuffs off." "Removing the cuffs," Major Casal said. "We made an agreement with all of you, an agreement between the college and the students about classified material. You entered into that agreement." "Freely," Beidelman said. "Well, no. But the agreement was known to you. When you discovered the schematics for the Panther engine encoded in the college's memory and available to anyone who happened for any reason whatsoever, as to ask for a practical application of pre-Socratic..." "I was surprised as hell," Beidelman said. "I still am. Loyalty is an ethical principle. I'll tell you what. I will waive the punishment factor and put it on the basis of loyalty to the college. A responsible person obeys laws and agreements entered into. Return the schematics, and you can continue your courses here at the college. In fact, we'll give you permission to select what subjects you want. They won't be assigned to you. I think you're good college material. Think it over and report back to me tomorrow morning between 8 and 9 here in my office. Don't talk to anyone. Don't try to discuss it. You will be watched. Don't try to leave the grounds. Okay?" "Okay," Beidelman said woodenly. He dreamed that night that he had died. In his dream, vast spaces stretched out, and his father was coming toward him very slowly out of a dark glade and into the sunlight. His father seemed glad to see him, and Beidelman felt his father's love. When he awoke, the feeling of being loved by his father remained. As he put on his uniform, he thought about his father and how rarely in actual life he had gotten that love. It made him feel lonely now, his father being dead and his mother as well, killed in a nuclear power accident along with a whole lot of other people. They say someone important to you waits for you on the other side, he thought. Maybe by the time I die, Major Casals will be dead, and he'll be waiting for me to greet me gladly. Major Casals and my father combined as one. What am I going to do? He asked himself. They've waived the punitive aspects. It's reduced to essentials. It's a matter of loyalty. Am I a loyal person? Do I qualify? The hell with it, he said to himself. He looked at his watch. 8:30. My father would be proud of me, he thought, for what I am going to do. Going into the laundry room, he scoped out the situation. No robots in sight. He dug down in the pile of bedsheets, found the pages of schematics, took them out, looked them over, and headed for the tube that would take him to Major Casals' office. You have them, Casals said as Bibleman entered. Bibleman handed the 3 sheets of paper to him. And you made no other copies? Casals said. No. You give me your word of honor? Yes, Bibleman said. You are herewith expelled from the college, Major Casals said. What? Casals pressed a button on his desk. Come in. The door opened, and Mary Lawrence stood there. I do not represent the college, Major Casals said to Bibleman. You were set up. I am the college, Mary said. Major Casals said, sit down, Bibleman. She'll explain it to you before you leave. I failed, Bibleman said. You failed me, Mary said. The purpose of the test was to teach you to stand on your own feet, even if it meant challenging authority. The covert message of institutions is submit to that which you psychologically construe as an authority. A good school trains the whole person. It isn't a matter of data and information. I was trying to make you morally and psychologically complete. But a person can't be commanded to disobey. You can't order someone to rebel. All I could do was give you a model, an example. Bibleman thought, when she talked back to Casals at the initial orientation. He felt numb. The Panther engine is worthless, Mary said, as a technological artifact. This is a standard test we use on each student, no matter what study course he is assigned. They all get a readout on the Panther engine? Bibleman said with disbelief. He stared at her. They will. One by one. Yours came very quickly. First, you are told that it is classified. You are told the penalty for releasing classified information. Then you are leaked the information. It is hoped that you will make it public, or at least try to make it public. Major Casals said, you saw on the 3rd page of the printout that the engine supplied an economical source of hydroelectric power. That was important. You knew that the public would benefit if the engine design was released. And the legal penalties were waived, Mary said. So what you did was not done out of fear. Loyalty, Bibleman said. I did it out of loyalty. Loyalty to what? Mary said. He was silent. He couldn't think. To you, Bibleman said. Major Casals said, I am someone who insulted you and derided you, someone who treated you like dirt. I told you that if I ordered you to pee purple, you... Okay, Bibleman said. Enough. Goodbye, Mary said. What? Bibleman said, startled. You're leaving. You're going back to your life and your job, what we had before we picked you. Bibleman said, I'd like another chance. But, Mary said, now you know how the test works, so it can never be given to you again. You know what it is, what is really wanted from you by the college. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, too, Major Casals said. Bibleman said nothing. Holding out her hand, Mary said, shake. Blindly, Bibleman shook hands with her. Major Casals only stared at him blankly. He did not offer his hand. He seemed to be engrossed in some other topic, probably some other person, another student on his mind, perhaps. Bibleman could not tell. 3 nights later, as he wandered aimlessly through the mixture of lights and darkness of the city, Bob Bibleman saw ahead of him a robot food vendor at its eternal post. A teenage boy was in the process of buying a taco and an apple turnover. Bob Bibleman lined up behind the boy and stood waiting, his hands in his pockets. No thoughts coming to him, only a dull feeling, a sense of emptiness, as if the inattention which he had seen on Casal's face had taken him over, he thought to himself. He felt like an object among objects, like the robot vendor. Something which, as he well knew, did not look you directly in the eye. "What will it be, sir?" Bibleman said. "Fries, a cheeseburger, and a strawberry shake." "Are there any contests?" "Not for you, Mr. Bibleman." "Okay," he said and stood waiting. The food came on its little throwaway plastic tray, in its little throwaway cartons. "I'm not paying," Bibleman said, and walked away. The robot called after him,
$1,100, Mr. Bibleman, you're breaking the law."
He turned and got out his wallet. "Thank you, Mr. Bibleman," the robot said. "I am very proud of you."
You have just heard "The Exit Door Leads In" by Philip K. Dick. This song asks its own question. It's Natalie Merchant.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Thank you.
Natalie Merchant. Oh, what? From The House Carpenter's Daughter. My favorite album of hers. I won't say the best, or, you know, I'm not going to get into that whole thing. I will say that is my favorite album of hers, given all the great folk music and traditional songs and stuff that she does in that album. And that version of Which Side Are You On? Wow. I mean, if that doesn't, you know, get your blood moving, then your blood don't flow. This is, speaking of blood flowing, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, Pacifica Radio in New York City at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. And we have, about 10 minutes left. Before that, you heard The Exit Door Leads In by Philip K. Dick. The version I was reading from is the Citadel Twilight edition, the Collected Stories of Philip K. Dick, Volume 5, The Eye of the Sibyl. And there's a Library of America edition of Philip K. Dick's stuff at this point that was edited by Jonathan Lethem. And, well, you know, Dick was at one time relatively to the mainstream of America, obscure writer. And he is now probably the primary font, next to, I guess, Marvel Comics, of movies, most of them action movies, for no good reason, because that's not why he writes. I mean, do yourself a favor and read the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And then watch the movie Blade Runner. And, or even better, read the short story I Can Remember It For You Wholesale and see the first version, they're remaking it, of Total Recall. And see if they have anything in common. There actually is about 2 minutes in the movie that relate to Philip K. Dick. And the rest of it, well, simply not. But I am interested if any of you out there have specific thoughts about this short story. I think it's really one of his most provocative and compelling ones. It's not just, you know, an adventure. It's not just a mind bleep, which is what so many of his stories are. It's not an examination into what is the authentic human being. It wears its heart on its sleeve, and it's a story about conformity, when doing the wrong thing is the right thing to do, when to stand up for people instead of just authority. And it's a brilliant, fun, and funny story. 1979 it was written. Now, you gotta hate any short story that is set in the far, far future, like the 21st century, and says, the 21st century is hell. You know, it's like, oh, please. It's only 30 years. Hard to believe that, as I said earlier, that Phil Dick has been dead now for about 31 years. But anyway, if you would like to discuss that short story or have questions about that kind of stuff in general, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Next week, oh yeah, I didn't mention. Yes, we're going into Begathon starting next week for a month, and I may or may not be on during that time. But one thing I will be doing during that interregnum is during the Nebula Awards, the third week in May, I will be going to Washington, D.C., not only to simply attend the awards, but I will be conducting interviews. And oh my God, they had a sign-up form for writers who wanted to be interviewed. It returned 37 names. I will be recording well over 30 interviews. One of them, by the way, will be Mike Fink. Who's he? He's an astronaut who just, you know, loves science fiction. It's just going to be cool. I'll be coming back with all kinds of recordings and material like that. So be forewarned. June is going to be way cool. Genevieve Valentine will be here also to talk about movies. She's nominated for a Nebula Award for Best Novel, her first novel, Mechanique. And, well, I'll tell you all about it at that time. And before that, Edward Einhorn will be here to discuss his off-Broadway production of The Lathe of Heaven, based on the novel by Ursula K. Le Guin. I'm really looking forward to that, based on if his adaptation of Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was any indication of what he does with theater, then this will be a great production. Good morning, you're on the radio. Hello? I can hear your radio vaguely. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, you made only 18 mistakes during that reading.
Very good, thank you. Yeah. I'm sure there were actually more. Your point being what? I didn't think you had a point. Okay, and good morning, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Tom from the Bronx here.
Very good.
I'd like to say that was a very deep story.
It really is.
Very deep. And it had a very modernized version of the original, too, in a way.
The original being?
Well, meaning from the original character.
Oh, which character are you referring to specifically?
Well, in other words, that's biblical, right?
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not aware of that, but given...
Well, it seems like it's biblical.
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised, you know, given the name that it's Bob Bibleman, and knowing that Philip K. Dick was a biblical scholar, I'm not surprised to learn that, but I'm totally unaware of it. You know something I don't.
Well, something that, the way you mention it, it seems very biblical.
Well, that knowing Philip K. Dick, who wrote his own exegesis and tried to learn Aramaic so he could read the Bible in its original language, and yeah, he wrote a lot of bizarre, wonderful religious stories.
It was almost like Jesus Christ Superstar, right? I mean, from the movie?
I'll take your word on that.
I mean, to me, it seemed that way anyway.
That's an interesting perspective. I mean, certainly one of his novels, Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, is absolutely based on the story of the Good Samaritan. And his novel, Valus, well... It's I think a good word to describe it is it's freaky. But in there, God exists as a huge amoeba-like thing in outer space, while in the meantime, a five-year-old girl named Sophia, which is a biblical reference, is basically a version of Christ, but based on some kind of Greek orthodox telling. I mean, he was really into this stuff.
Well, in other words, the wandering through the village would be like Jerusalem, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, it hit me that way, that's for sure.
I think that's appropriate.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great morning.
Phenomenal.
Okay, take care.
Okie doke.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's see. Wait, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. The number here is 212-209-2900. And, yeah, I know there were flubs in the reading, but, hey, that's live radio. We don't record it. You do it as it comes. And also, by the way, something I really have to apologize for, I had to censor that story en route. There are a lot of F-words in there, but hopefully the rearrangement that I did hopefully did not take the edge of the story off. But hey, again, that's live radio, and if that person, that first person who called up, he's just an ass. You can figure out the second syllable of that for yourself. It's a voice I know has been doing it for years. And as I said, your point being what? Yeah, there were mistakes. Hopefully the content came through, as the second caller seemed to have gotten some content out of it. Good morning, you're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, my point being that you're not a good reader.
Oh, that's your opinion.
You freeze up.
No, I don't freeze up. I'm a bigger critic of my own readings than you are. And you know what? Who cares? You're off. Hung up on him. It's just a jerk. As pointed out, the story came across to other people. So, if I recorded it, you wouldn't hear any mistakes. You can get the best people in the world reading. And, well, things happen. But you know what? After 40 years of doing this, I will apologize for flubs, but I'm not going to apologize for doing it. So there. Any more calls at 212-209-2900? I'm going to wait for a couple more to come in. There's only one, and I suspect I know who that is. So I want another as backup. Next week on this program, no idea. I may or may not be here. Oh, join the Facebook group, Hour of the Wolf. You can look it up. There's even a Google Plus group if you're into that. Or more importantly, just visit the website. That's more permanent home, which is ourwolf.com, ourwolf.com, com. And, that person gave up because, as I said, I know who it was. Let's see if this is somebody else. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I thought you read the story very well.
I would give it a B.
Oh, definitely. And when I started listening to the story, I was like, where's this going? It was very complex, and like the other caller said, very deep. But I couldn't turn the radio off because I got so interested in it. Then when he got the plans for the Panther engine, I was like, okay, they're setting him up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's set up through the entire story. And we know that from the start, but the whole question is, there's two parts of it. One is all of society like that. Everywhere he turns, it's like that. And one sort of wonders, who is that college? What was that college about?
Yeah, really. It was like, was it a military school? It didn't even have a name.
Yeah, exactly. And it turns out that Mary Lorne, simply says, I am the college.
Right, she's the college.
Yeah, herself. So,
right, because she seems to know everything,
Yeah, exactly, and she does because she invented all that, and that's a typical kind of an icon, in the classic sense of the word, in Philip K. Dick, where you have characters like that.
Right.
It was
a very interesting story, and I really like your show.
Thank you.
And keep up the good work. And I hope that lady doesn't call back again. All right. You have a good night, sir.
Okay, you too. Thanks so much. Take
care.
Bye-bye. Okay, and that sort of like proved my point. The content comes through. So anyhow, I only have 30 seconds left, so I'm not going to take more calls. I want to play Sales of Silver through properly instead of just starting it in the background. So I will thank you all for listening. Remind you that on May Day at 138 Sullivan Street, I will be presenting the great John Shirley and the amazing Michael Sisko, two fabulous writers, reading their works. Admission is free. I hope to see you then. More information at ourwolf.com as promised, or on Facebook. And well, that's it. I will see you. I talk to you relatively soon. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming on these airwaves right now. But first, Steel Eye Span.
Expressing my myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Cause my hurt is internal, the American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking. Get the flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Acting like you know, You don't know, you don't know, you don't know. What are the caucus like? I chat, you a chat. I chat, you a chat. Talking about this and that. Chat, chat, chat. Yeah, those leaders seated up in prison, they are to be blamed. For they wanted it all. Mr. Too Fat and his friends. Yes, they licked the platter clean. They never thought about a little, little, little tummy ball outside. I waiting for some scraps. Hey, Mr. Too Fat, you're too fat. And you've been too fat for too long. They won't fat and can't get and too thin. Them guys are outside. And knock and knock and knock and knock 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 knocking at your door. And they won't stop, oh no sir, until they get some of your fat. You hear that, Mr. Too Fat? Them guys won't stop. Them guys won't stop. Won't stop. Won't stop. Why? Won't you stop? You seat up in your reasoning, acting like you know. You don't know, you don't know, you don't know. What other clock just struck? I chat, you a chat. I chat, chat, chat. Ooh, chat, chat, chat. Yes, I'm too fat. You too fat. You've been too fat for too long. Hey, one fat can't get
too thin. No, man.
Too thin.
Guys are outside.
Guys are outside. And knock and knock and knock and knock 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 in at your door. And they won't stop. No, no, they won't stop.
Time won't be like the first time. Watch out, not coming like a lamb to be slaughtered. It's coming like a bony jug. My teachers are much proud of the world. So can the mother stand the key? So I will judge you. Hey! And so you have to go over the top and take it up. The key of song will really come to us. I live the life you love. So you got to be my church, you know. Hey! Look at that! Song coming from to the floor.